I'm hearing that nobody's fallen in love with anything, although I personally love looking for Eric this morning, which does not have U.S. distribution at this time. So the best movie I've seen is not going to be seen by American viewers until, unless something else happens between now and the festival or whatever. But yeah, everybody says it's a slow year, but the thing is that the festival always, always has some gem, and maybe that gem hasn't been revealed yet. That's kind of my feeling.
My sense is that Bright Star played very well, the Jane Campion film, which Bob Burney's new company picked up before the festival. Sight Unseen, which is unusual these days. They saw it about 2 weeks before the festival. The Ang Lee movie played to very mixed response, taking Woodstock, and I think the focus feature people are going to have to do some adjusting of their marketing plan going forward, try to recover from that at other festivals, perhaps. The Odeyard played, A Prophet, played very, very well with the critics, 2.5 hours long, and I expect that a U.S. distributor, Sony Pictures Classics, perhaps, would pick that film up. They picked up the Haneke film already, and IFC, of course, has been on a buying spree. You know, these are films that are going to be shown possibly on VOD, not for necessarily for theatrical release or a very limited theatrical release. And Magnolia picked up John Woo's Red Cliff, which I'm surprised hasn't had more attention paid because it's, by all accounts, terrific. I understand.
I also think that when people say it's a slow sales climate, the other adjective that could be applied is reasonable. I think that we've had about a decade of buyer's remorse going on at festivals, and I think that slowing down reflects financial reality, certainly, but may also reflect something better for the state of the art. You know, the end of inflated prices and, worse, inflated enthusiasms.
I would just add that I think the real issue is there are a lot of very expensive movies here looking for North American distribution. I put Agora, Dr. Parnassus on that list, and Dr. Parnassus showed before the festival started and hasn't gotten a buyer yet. So I think you're right, but I also think that while the Sony Classics and the IFCs are going to make their deals, the very expensive movies that are looking for a $4 or $5 million minimum guarantee may not get it.
Well, I mean, definitely it seems like the discovery of the festival so far, and I still feel like it's early, but that's probably because I got here late. It seems like the thing that people are surprised that they're talking about is the ODR film. But, you know, on one level, it's really accessible. It's just kind of a really well-made crime film. On another level, it's 2.5 hours long. So that is challenging.
And it's in French.
And it's in French. Yeah.
No one has yet mentioned the Lars von Trier film, which played last night.
Is play the right verb?
Actually, that is the word that is the film that everybody's
Escape.
Talking about today. Whether anyone will wind up seeing it is another matter. I mean, I'd love to ask other people on the panel if they think this movie could actually be released in the United States in its current form.
I'm going to say yes because I think that all the attention the film has received since, you know, literally as I walked out of the theater last night, reading messages on Twitter about the reaction, the crowd booing and heckling the film, I started receiving text messages from friends in the States telling me they were excited to see it simply because of that. Now, that's not necessarily saying that there's a huge market for the film, but I think that all of the attention the film has received over the past 18 hours has been a tremendous marketing, tremendous amount of marketing for the film. And, you know, Lars von Trier declaring at the press conference today that he's the world's greatest director certainly doesn't hurt things.
But I think the question is, you know, has anybody figured out a way to translate Twitter messages into tickets sold? And I don't know of any distributors who are really, honestly, I really don't know of any who are fantastic at taking chatter on the internet and turning it into money.
I do know a buyer in particular, who told me just an hour ago that they love the film. So I won't be surprised to see it get a distribution deal. I don't know how well it'll do. I think it'll be a film that will be talked about.
Between von Trier's Jay-Z act and the egregious controversy, it'll get sold to somebody. The question is, will people see it solely because they want to have an opinion about how bad / grotesque / untenable it actually is?
I don't think anybody goes to see a movie to see how bad it is. I mean,
You don't think people go to films so they can take part in the cultural conversation about them?
No. Not if they know they're bad.
Well,
I think there's too many other things to do. I think, I mean, the movie would have to be released NC-17.
Or unrated.
I don't know. I mean, you talked about what, you know, whether or not Twitter can drive ticket sales. I think the more pertinent question is whether a clitorectomy can drive ticket sales. I just don't know what the audience is. Clitorectomy. If you haven't seen the film, I'm ruining the third act.
Yeah.
The third act was already ruined.
Spoiler alert!
So we'll stop there on the bus for now, and then we'll switch gears to the topic of this panel. So thank you for weighing in, for those of us in the room, to get a snapshot of what's happening. I want to start back where I referred to earlier regarding Twitter, and just as a way to sort of begin the discussion. I found it really interesting to be following the experience of the festival through Twitter and through the experiences of others who have been posting short messages about what they're seeing, what they're doing, what's happening at the festival. And I'm wondering how each of you is experiencing and approaching and writing about the festival differently in an era when Twitter and Facebook, to a certain extent, are allowing a much more immediate access point for folks who aren't here, and also for those who are here. And this is a way for us to just start talking about how the media landscape is changing, because I know that it's changing the way I experience a festival like this. And I'm wondering how.
Well, I'll take the contrary view, because I'm a traditional media person. I think it makes what the LA Times does more important, and that is that we don't try to Twitter. We don't try to do things that are, you know, just off the top of our heads. We go out and report stories, and we, you know, the last couple of festivals, we have had blogs, and we try to put stories up, but we don't, you know, put our thoughts on our website. We actually go out and report stories. So I'm hopeful that with all the Twittering and instant reaction that's out there, there's still a market and an appetite for thoughtful, well-reported news stories. And I think there's room for both, but I think it actually makes, I hope, it makes what the LA Times is doing more important in comparison, or certainly different in comparison rather than more important.
It makes the LA Times slower.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I would also argue that people who Twitter and people who use Facebook and people who file blogs are also reporting. Just because you're in a newspaper doesn't mean you're the only place that does reporting. And I get very annoyed by the suggestion that just because someone happens to blog, that doesn't mean that they report. And I also can report in a Twitter feed. I reported from the Von Trier last night, not what my opinion of the Von Trier was. I reported what happened. The people booed.
The thing is, you have one thing, John, that I would definitely argue about is I think that, and I'm only Twittering a little bit, I'm an experimental Twitterer because I don't really know what it accomplishes. But you have to say that for festivals, that stuff's kind of tailor-made. It's friggin' fantastic. Because when you're at a festival, you have and you're a reporter, you've got a million different pieces of information and experiences coming at you. You know you would never have time for everything that's in your notebook down into a story. And what people really want to know is, what does that taste like? What does that look like? What does that smell like? What does that feel like? And the good thing about something like Twitter, which I'm not a big fan of, because I don't really get it. I just do it because people tell me I should do it, basically. But I'm trying it, just like I tried blog 2 years ago, whatever, it gives people who are interested that sense of flavor and that flow, because it's like, you know, dipping in and out of a river, kind of, you know. So, by the way, that doesn't undermine what you said in the sense of I do think people still want thoughtful, analytical, well-reported stories that we're going to be doing from here, and they want a longer read, and they want to read, you know, Kenny Turan and Manola Darks' review. They're really, like, well-cogitated thoughts about the Lars von Trier movie. I really want to see what they have to say about it, that I don't have to actually go watch it. But you want both, I think.
Can I?
I agree with that, too.
I've been using Twitter since, I think, January of 2007, and as the years have gone on and as Twitter has sort of caught fire in the film community, which is really very recently, maybe in the past 6 months, what I do on Twitter and what I do on the blog has never been the same thing. And to use them in the same phrasing is strange to me. But the gap between the two has grown enormously. Twitter is not for what I consider, I don't consider it to be for reviews or for anything that should be in depth. It's for being pithy and being entertaining and basically getting people to pay attention to you so that then maybe they'll read your, you know, real writing. And I mean, as time goes on and I know that there are more people paying attention to Twitter, it's changed what I actually put on the blog because there's less of that on my blog now. Now my blog is pretty much chiefly for pieces that are more thoughtful and, you know, more like what you say in your newspaper.
Twitter is a great mechanism to distribute the URL to your actual goddamn story or review. It's a great mechanism for that.
That's how I use it.
And also it is a great venue for cocktail chatter. The thing is that, and this has been going on for years, the mania to be first on covering something is killing actual writing and actual intelligence, because I've had editors yell at me, you know, where's your review, person X, who can't write, can't think, doesn't get what's behind the film, doesn't know the world the film talks about, a way to talk about it properly. Well, they have a review up already, and it's like, well, you can have first or you can have smart. And this mania for first is idiotic. It's not a sporting contest. There's not a tape. I would much rather read something intelligent written a week after a film than some troglodyte who loves exclamation points writing about it 5 minutes afterwards.
I just think that this is the point. First of all, it doesn't really matter what you want. That's where the world is. And that's how people are communicating. So we all have to communicate the way people want to be communicated to. That's our job, right? So you may choose to read
I'm a firm believer that, you know, you should write cleanly and clearly and articulately, but you should also goddamn know what you're talking about. And the mania for first tends to occlude that and often get by it. I'm not saying that the early review of something can't be jolly good, but by and large, when somebody's like, woohoo, I was first on it, well, that's all they have. And the mania of speed is impossibly tedious. It's bad to read, it's bad to write, and it's bad when editors want it. And also, I write things that I would want to read, hypothetically. I don't know how to do anything but, which is why I'm barely employed and have 9 freelance gigs.
I will say that as much as I enjoy writing my blog, and I also have to pursue speed a lot of the time, I do find myself pulling back and really enjoying when I write longer pieces and have an assignment to do real reporting at great length that takes time, and that is what I enjoy most in the world.
I personally think that time is over. I do.
Well, you know, I would have said that.
Oh, definitely over if we all start acting like that.
I would have said that 2 years ago, but I've actually come to the point, you know, I mean, I'm actually regretful for my role in creating the sort of environment of speed, you know? I mean, when I started Cinematical in 2005, we had a mandate to publish between 10 and 20 posts a day, and I think that doing that and that becoming the trend of film journalism has become toxic. There are some people who do it really well, and there are a lot of people who do it very badly. And I personally, as a reader, feel like I'm drowning in noise, and I wish everybody would just kind of slow down a little.
The other thing is that a lot of online sites are now figuring out what they want to do on the basis of what's going to draw the most traffic, and that's a very dangerous trend, because celebrities draw the most traffic. And there are pieces that are going to be read by certain opinion makers or that are going to have a great deal of influence in a small group of people that aren't necessarily going to play big to all the people in the world. And it's a dangerous trend, I think.
Well, only a fool cares about nothing but charisma and star power, but only a bigger fool would deny charisma and star power exists. And I think you can balance good work and good cheekbones. You can balance a discussion of star heat with what those movies are actually about.
I mean, I was just going to say that the depressing thing for me is that every single month when we look at our traffic metrics, we get 70% of our traffic from Google searches. And the top 10 Google searches are always going down the list: masturbation, porno, sex scenes, movie sex, naked movie.
Lindsay Lohan naked.
You can find all of that stuff.
Right. So it's like, you know, if I wanted to write about masturbation, I'd write about masturbation, but I thought I was writing about movies.
Well, you don't have to do that. First of all, you check your traffic once a month?
No, I check my traffic every day, but for the total for the month.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Let me switch gears slightly as a way of kind of digging more deeply into each of the different sort of models that are at work represented by the folks on this panel. And I'm going to go to Sharon first because I think that as we look at the way that the, let's talk about trade federalism for a moment and how it's changed dramatically, certainly over the past 6 months. In that period of time, you've launched therap.com, and it's starting to get traction. It's getting a lot of attention. It's getting linked. It's getting talked about, you know, among, you know, other journalists and other media. Tell us about your strategy as it relates to what we were just talking about, this idea of urgency, timeliness, reporting, balancing that need to be first, but also to report solidly, because you're trying to bring a not only an urgency, but quality to the work you're doing. How are you balancing that? What is the what is your mandate you're giving to yourself and to the other folks at the RAP? And what goals do you have?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. Well, that's a very good analysis, basically, of where we're trying to position ourselves, which is we have perceived a real void in the marketplace of information for information that is accurate, of high quality, authoritative, and delivered in the way that people want to read it. That means to say in real time, that means to say delivered on every platform where people access information, whether that's their PDF, whether that's on their iPhone, whether that's on their computer, and hopefully we'll be on a lot more platforms as we grow. And so what I believe that we've established in the first 3 months of being up and running, which have been, you know, a whirlwind and very fun and exciting, I have to say, has been to prove that thesis, that there is a demand for that just by the fact that we've come in and been able to grab attention from...
But with all due respect, you also ran that fan-created avatar trailer as an actual news story, and I believe that was the intersection of egg and face, was it not?
Oh my God, that's so funny. I mean, yeah, but who cares? I mean, so we put up for an hour a trailer that was a fan-created trailer. Then we made fun of ourselves, and that's fun. So yeah, we made a mistake. Wow, I mean, so yeah, we made a mistake. I'm okay with that. But then we just told
them. I didn't bring my witch hunting gear.
That's okay. That's okay. I don't know. No, but actually, this is sort of fun. We put up, I mean, this was like, I don't even think this qualifies as a blip, but since James brought it up. We posted in something that we curate work. We don't only do original content, we do our own reporting, but we curate the stuff that we think is most interesting and relevant from around the world of entertainment and media. And one of the things we showed was a clip that we thought was, that some editor thought was a trailer for Avatar, turned out to be something that fans had put together, which is very, very good, by the way, for fans. Like, people are really good at this stuff. And not being Avatar nerds, we were taken for an hour. But then we sort of said, this has been done by fans. So, but it is definitely a balance. I mean, I personally started out at Reuters. It was sort of my first big job in journalism. And being an internet era journalist is the closest analog I can find to that, sort of, of what journalists have done until now is wire service journalism, because there's never been a deadline. If you work for the Associated Press or if you work for Reuters, it's always now or 5 minutes ago. And you're always, always in that tension of, is it confirmed? Is it accurate? Are you going to get beat by the other guy? Are you going to get beat by UPI? You're going to get beat by AP or by AP or the German French press agency? So it's very much in that zone that I'm training young journalists, and that the editors who are working with me are constantly dealing with. So for example, sometimes, here's a good example, a very aggressive news blogger called Vicky Fink. She may put a news story out. We feel we need to tell our readers. I'm not always sure if her information is correct. So that's the tension. Do I tell my readers something that I've not yet confirmed at that instant that Nikki Fink has blogged? You know, those are kind of tough calls. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, and I want to hear your take on this, because you're going through a transition in your career, it seems, after or in the process of leaving Variety. I'll let you explain what you're up to and how your blog has changed what you do and sort of what you want to do and how you look at this environment. Because obviously, I'm not going to make you comment on Variety or on any of that, because it might be you're still working with that. But I wonder how you view this change that's happening, because you've been a part of it. And
Well, I've worked at so many places, from monthly magazines like Premiere and weeklies like EW and the LA Weekly, and I've covered the industry from all sorts of different places and different points of view. And when I went to The Hollywood Reporter, I created the Risky Biz blog, and it was the first blog they'd ever had. And I don't know what instinct made me want to do that, but I just felt like it was something that needed to happen. And it took off, and it was a great deal of fun to invent it, to create it. And Jeff Wells at Hollywood Elsewhere and other people, David Poland at Movie City News, were doing their own thing. And Nikki got started at The Weekly as well. And then I took that, I started a new blog at Variety. But the trades, like all newspapers, are under a great deal of duress right now. A lot of financial hardship, trouble with advertising, layoffs. And I am going to take the blog and start my own blog, you know, do the independent thing. And, you know, it's fascinating for me to look around the landscape and figure out how to monetize a blog, where the income might come from, where the audience might come from, how to keep the audience in a very, very competitive world that has gotten more and more crowded. And the trade space, of course, with Sharon and The Wrap, and others, IndieWire, among others, has become very crowded as well. It's fun, daunting, and exciting, but I find that short-form, quick journalism is very effective, that you can have a voice, that you can have a following, and you can communicate with people. I just have an instinct for what people want to know, and I feel like I'm providing a service. And I give them a sort of aggregated sense of all the different things that are going on. I comment, I link, I try to be very generous about what I'm sharing. And I'm not necessarily reporting all the time, but I do some reporting as well.
And isn't that really just a pain in the ass? Like, hasn't the media landscape changed so much in the past couple of years that it's really psychotic?
Yes.
Yeah.
In a word.
Well, I think Karina's to blame for that, though.
Sorry. But I mean, you know, that model of we got to post all day long because we got to have page views because that's what advertisers want. You know, great. But I just personally, it's not really what I'm crazy about reading right now, and I'm kind of looking to do something else.
Such as?
I don't know. We'll see. Still figuring it out.
Churning your own butter, handmade furniture.
That sounds really nice, actually. Yeah, it sounds like a really good vacation.
Well, the thing is that the page views thing, you know, as I'm sure you know, Eugene, is not, it can be a trap also. Because what actually everybody at this table has is access to a very sought after audience, which are the people who are interested and who run the entertainment industry. I think that everyone here, if we sit and think carefully about how we explain what we do to the advertising community and actually educate them about what we bring, which is not just click, 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 page views, Lindsay Lohan naked, but something more intelligent than that, and that's absolutely the place that I come from.
Why is Lindsay Lohan naked?
Yeah. No. You can do a Lindsay Lohan story, and you can have a look at the anatomy of a career over 10 years. There are certainly celebrity stories to be done, but when you talk about a crowded space, that's a crowded space. I'm not going to compete with Perez Hilton, and I don't really want the kinds of ads like Perez. I would love you to pick me up at any time. Thank you so much. But if you look at the ads on that site, they're not the kinds of high quality ads that are going to and high CPM, right? High rate ads. Put simply, that will sustain a proper news organization. So we have to. So I think that not only do we do better for ourselves when we elevate the coverage, but and we bring in a more discerning audience, which all of us wants to write for anyway. But we have to go out and make that argument to the advertising community and tell them that this is where you want to be.
Let me bring John into this because I think that we can talk about how trades are changing. We can talk about blogs and their effectiveness and their role, but I think that I can't imagine anyone in this room would disagree with the statement that despite the changes happening at print newspapers, despite the changes happening at the LA Times, New York Times, other places, John still represents the place where, if I'm a publicist, I see publicists in the room, he's still the most powerful journalist at this table because he represents the Los Angeles Times, and they have a print publication that, despite the challenges that are being faced, reach a tremendous audience. Their website is highly trafficked. That reporting that we talked about earlier is highly valued, and that brand name, the Los Angeles Times, just like the New York Times, just like the Wall Street Journal, has value. So, John, how do you look at your place and the ground underneath you as it's changing, and how do you view where trade journalism may be in 6 months, in a year? Where will Variety be? Where will the
I think both trades will be online only. Probably by the end of the year. I mean, there's no advertising in them. I don't see how they can survive as print publications. I think they still have a need, and I think they'll still continue to exist, and I think there's some sort of financial model for them. I just don't think it's as a print publication. I mean, what the thing that I hear here that I think is a little bit confusing is everybody's talking to a certain extent about being quick, about Twittering, about having content about the film business very quickly, and I think there's a market for that. There's a market for the New York Times. There's also a market for the New Yorker. So there's different kinds of readers at different kinds of speeds. I think the challenge for the LA Times, and it's something we struggle with every day, is you know what is the balance between instant reporting and analysis, and what is the challenge, and what is the balance between longer stories? Our readers are not generally Twitterers. Some of them might be, but if they want Twitter information about the film business, they're not going to find it on the LA Times. That's not our mission. That's not what our readers look for. It's not what I want to do. And I don't think it's what my editors want me to do. I think what, and I said this earlier, I think the challenge for the paper is to continue to do what we've done well and also meet the challenges of new media. I mean, there are a lot of good entertainment news sites out there, and they sometimes beat us on stories. But I think if you look at the volume and quality of the LA Times phone coverage, it's second to none in this anywhere. I don't think there's any paper that comes close to us. I don't think there's any website that comes close to us. But we have a different role, and our role is not to be. And I hope you know, when there is a breaking news story, I hope we can be competitive in any realm, if it's in breaking news, if it's in entertainment news. But we're actually going to make a phone call before we write a story. We're going to do some reporting. I mean, there are blogs, and they're represented at this table, that have written things about the LA Times that were factually inaccurate. If somebody had picked up a phone, we would have been able to tell them. So our concern, I mean, I think our mission is to make the extra phone call, to do the reporting, and have stories that have more credibility to them.
I just wanted to point out that the LA Times uses Twitter and sends out your stories via Twitter. You don't do it, but your paper does.
I'm not a personal Twitter.
It's a distribution mechanism.
Yeah, and I also wanted to, with no disrespect at all intended to John, who I'm quite sure is very, very powerful, I would just caution you to take a step back, because all of those monikers or hierarchies, all of that's kind of blown up into smithereens in the past year or two. And you have bloggers who are completely untrained, non-professional writers. And I'm not just talking in this domain, I'm talking about in politics and lots of other places, whether it's Wong Kett, who you could say she might have been in her pajamas writing her blog, but she was certainly, and still is, you know, a very powerful force as a writer, as a journalist. And I think that everyone who's in the publicity world, the communication world, is absolutely taking the measure of all of that, and that's all being recalibrated as we see now.
And also with respect to John, who I just met today and seems like a great human being, but as much as I admire the Times' coverage, I don't buy the LA Times because that involves giving money to Sam Zell, who is a horrible tax-dodging multimillionaire. I would much rather patronize another.
He's getting poorer by the minute.
And he deserves to. But right now, if I subscribe
to Times, but that's our real problem, is that people who read news online are not used to paying for it. And the LA Times, like a lot of print publications, a lot of online publications, has not figured out a way to make money in equal measure, given greater number of readers online. But I want to just add one thing. I mean, just So you don't think I sit in my, you know, canned apartment and spend 3 weeks writing a story. The other day, I, you know, thought I should do, and I think Anne did this, although I haven't seen your item, something about the imaginary of Dr. Parnassus. Now, I put up a blog post about how the movie hadn't sold. I spoke to 7 film buyers, all of whom had seen the film, and all of whom were probably going to pass on the film. I called the sales agent for the film. It was a 3-paragraph story. So I made 8 phone calls for a 3-paragraph story. Now, other people at this table could do, I hear Dr. Parnassus is not selling, and I'm not saying one has greater value than the other, but I'm not comfortable doing the story where I don't make those phone calls.
And I did report something a while back based on those screenings in LA, and I did talk to some of the buyers, and it was a good week before your story. I didn't call 7.
Fortunately, mine will be read by more people.
No, this is true. Now, the other point I was going to make is that the New York Times is coming up with a couple of different models for trying to create a pay structure for newspapers, and that is where they're going to have to go.
I would also add that there are some people at this table who write news and some people at this table who write primarily reviews and interviews. I have the journalistic skills of a very large golden retriever, but I primarily make my living writing reviews and writing interviews where that's less required, and it works out okay for me.
I think what was amazing today, and you guys may have noticed it, is Variety's review of the Ken Loach movie was up about 2 hours after the movie ended. I thought that was unbelievable.
Well, that's the new trend. I've watched Todd and Justin do their reviews, and they do an incredible job. And so I might add, does IndieWire. And they get them out very, very quickly, and that's there's a huge demand for that. And especially IndieWire is very good at getting the news alerts out very quickly. Very, very adept at that.
I mean, that's something we're trying to figure out the right balance for. I mean, I think that we looked at Eric in the back, who writes reviews for us, and you know, editor, one of our editors, Brian, is here. We're trying to figure out the balance with the writers. There is a pressure to put a perspective out as quickly as possible, but we have to figure out what the right balance is to be able to do it. In a way that's responsible. I mean, I think that it's something that I know that in our case we're still trying to figure out. I think there's room for a snapshot, a quick take, a perspective on a film that can be contributed rather quickly, but then also I think it's valuable to have something longer or something that's meatier that maybe compares and connects the dots between among a number of films that might not be published immediately but might be published a week later. And we're trying to figure that out. I don't know what the answer is.
I'd love to ask John a question about how the print side and the online side of the LA Times works out, because if there were more, less separation perhaps more cohesion.
This may be news to people who read the LA Times. LATimes.com, in terms of entertainment coverage, and the LA Times are totally separate entities. The entertainment side of our website answers to Chicago. We have no jurisdictional control over them. So very occasionally, more often than I would like, stories that are prominent in the calendar section will not land on our entertainment page at all. The entertainment page of LATimes.com is much more celebrity-driven. It's much more Elizabeth Snead, American Idol type story. So yeah, it makes no sense to me. It's the way it is. And it's unfortunate.
There are folks in the audience from various aspects of the film community, other journalists as well. I would love to incorporate your comments, your questions, your opinions on what you've heard so far. I have a few more questions that I'll get to as well. But just raise your hand, tell us who you are briefly, and ask your question or make your comment. We have a microphone that is being handed. Tell us who you are, please.
Hi, my name is Francis Shaw. I'm not from the entertainment industry. However, I was publishing 50 years ago. I can't agree more with Sharon in the sense that Wikipedia, which has been very much criticized by university and academia, okay, today has already established itself as a reference. And yes, it is a landslide. Yes, all institutions modeled after the 20th century, 19th century, a very formal capitalist structure that holds the means of production are completely present. Okay, and should we think in terms of a conversation between the audience and their institution rather than trying to preserve their institutions? So, yes, Peter, yes, why don't we be first and best? I don't see why there's any possibility with this. Okay, from a purely logic point of view, there's no possibility between being present as. And second, there will be auto-regulation. I mean, why do we need to believe that people are fools and that they won't go for quality on their own? Wikipedia has completely proved that auto-regulation.
Well, okay, but I want to argue back. I thank you for agreeing with me, which is, means you're brilliant. But I just want to argue back on one point, which is, if what happens is that all of us move, all of us users, all of us readers, right? Because we're both here, producers and users. If we, in this rush to all this vast sea of information, we abandon the institutions, the fear is, I understand what you're saying because I'm living it every day. We lose something very precious when we lose the LA Times. We will lose something very precious if we were to lose the New York Times. Yeah. And that doesn't mean that there isn't room for all these new organizations like our own to be high quality, fast, and the best. Mm-hmm. But there is something that will be impossible or very difficult to recapture once we lose those institutions. And so they are worth trying to figure out how to have them evolve rather than have everything, which looks like where we're going now is that everything goes toward collapse and then small organizations grow up in their wake, but we will lose something.
Okay, let me add one thing. Okay, but then it's a real question of leadership.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the work I do, seriously. And most leaders actually approach that dilemma from a resistance point of view as opposed from a coexistence point of view.
I agree with that, actually.
That's why we're here, by the way. Some other people are coming along with the conversation, which I don't think we need to be.
I think that a lot of newspapers, the people who run them, the people who are in charge or in power, are defending the print model, they're defending the old advertising model, and they're not willing to advance into the future. And the longer they drag their heels, the worse it will be. At the same time, I hang on to my LA Times subscription. I read the print edition every day because I want John to keep his job.
Thank you.
Well,
that says my wife.
The other thing is that if anything would be described at times reading Mr. Horn, I think that everything in the 21st century is problematic in that Henry Ford used to say, why do you pay your workers such high wages? Well, his workers couldn't afford to buy his cars. He couldn't afford to make them. And now we live in a landscape where your appliances, your furniture, your media is being made by cheap or unpaid labor, and you're just expected to go along with it. I will pay money and subscribe to institutions that pay people a good wage and that I one day aspire to work for. And I think that everyone has to kind of tough it up and go, hey, as a citizen of the kind of century I would like to live in, I am willing to pay for well-made furniture that's made in America, well-made appliances that are made in America, well-made media that's made by people who are paid a decent wage. I don't like not having dental. I don't like having 9 different gigs. I do it because I don't know how to do anything else.
Question in the third row, Charles.
Amor Amenas of the newer head of the Film Society Link Center. And as I'm thinking, listening to you guys, I'm thinking about what's a sustainable economic model of the future, or I'm sure there's a few. I can't help noticing how so many of you have splintered off from major places. And I wonder whether there's going to be a coming together in a different form. And I can't help think of the Huffington Post in some way, right? Because which does have a lot of advertising, right? And
yeah, but they don't have any reporting staff. They just aggregate other people's content. I mean, I think that's one of the real problems with the internet, is that they're aggregating content from people like us who are out there reporting it.
Actually, what the Huffington does is they let people blog for free.
They don't pay anybody.
It's original, but they blog for free. They don't get paid.
A friend of mine ran the editorial side of Huffington Post. She was like, try it, and you'll dig it. It can be a great place for all those little things you can't put anywhere else. And then after I did it 4 times, I realized, this is a business model based upon me not getting paid and multimillionaires making even more money.
But I
grew up in Canada where people die from exposure. Never write for free.
Mara, I would like to think that what you want to see happen will happen.
Let's put a few facts on the table. Hang on a second. First of all, our model is a combination of Huffington Post and, say, when people ask, I'm going to say we're kind of a combination of Politico, which is niche-oriented, subject-oriented, vertical-driven journalism, original content,
and blogging. Huffington Post has now become, it's just in different proportions. There are 9 full-time reporters at the Huffington Post. All of the commentary is for free, and you're right, they rewrite and aggregate a lot of material, and it's not my job to defend Huffington Post or not, but they do pay for AP, and they have, and they're, as I've heard Ariana Sinks, I've been on plenty of panels with her talking about exactly the subject, that, you know, the New York Times is delighted when they pick up her story, and I'm delighted when she picks up my story, as I think she did today, because I asked an editor to pick up a story from Com. So, and in fact,
you said there are people who are getting paid for work.
There are, so because we were on a panel at the LA Times Book Festival like 2 weeks ago, and she mentioned it, that's how I know. There are 9 reporters on staff. That's nowhere near enough to fill that news hole, which is, you know, apart from the news hole being endless, it's the internet. But I mean, there's a certain space on that page. And so the question is, our model is we pay for news, we do not pay for commentary. So we want to be a place where people come in and comment on the news for because they want to be part of this community and heard by their colleagues, but we pay for news.
It does
reporting.
It does beg the question about the future, because if you think about what if all those people decided not to work for free, and then because I agree with you, I mean, that site is now apparently worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
No, the site is not worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
I understand it's not in profit.
There's a lot of misinformation going around here, so I'll just leave it there.
What do you know, Sharon?
No, I just, it's not my job to inform people about, you know, other news organizations. It's certainly not my role. However, only because I'm an entrepreneur in this space, so I pay attention to what my colleagues are doing. I do know that her company was recently valued at $100 million. She raised $25 million in January, around the same time that we closed our funding for our company. And she just told me recently they have that many reporters that I just mentioned. So, and I have spoken to Ariana recently, and she says they're in profit, but they're not a public company, so no one can verify that.
As recent events have shown us, valuations of companies are always perfectly accurate.
Well, she raised $25 million based on that, and so that's...
Let's take some more questions from the audience. We have one here, and then we're going into the room.
Yeah, hi, my name is Garth Paul. Eugene mentioned about people here in the audience from Film Community. I'm from filmcommunity.com. We're an online platform for the films you provide. And we have a lot of bloggers, and I'd just like to talk mostly about Twitter because of the early comments made about Twitter and how aggregation works. We've got several Twitter feeds working, one in fact relating to Canada at the moment, which is links to all the major trades reviews from Canada. So we, I'm afraid, are guilty of aggregating good content. We don't take credit for that. It's aggregated, curated, and totally attributed.
But you shouldn't feel guilty about that because you're exposing stories to audiences that might not see it otherwise.
Yeah, well,
because if the LA Times readers don't use Twitter, but there are people on Twitter, you know, who don't read the LA Times, that therefore, you know, so they'll read the story.
Yeah, and are you linking to stories, or are you just taking the whole story and putting it up on your site?
No, I'm linking to stories. We're giving credit with credit to you. I'm just trying to take some of Karina's guilt off for the other.
Oh, thank you. But I'm self-flagellating.
Would you repeat the name of your site?
Filmcommunity.com. It's, as I said, an online platform for the whole film industry, but we do have a lot of people blogging, and they write, and we have film critics who produce work, so we're very aware of what's happening, and we also have the Hollywood Reporter as a media partner, so we're very aware as well of the established. But I'd like to give complete credit to the journalists and writers who take time to cover the stories, because Canada is changing very, very rapidly, and people are putting it up quickly, and it relies on in-depth, serious analysis of film, everything to survive. So, you know, fine, I feel guilty about that aspect of it, but I'm still very aware that we want to use social media to spread good writing as far as possible.
I think we all do. Is there a question mark in that sentence, or just a period?
There was a semicolon.
Okay.
We'll go behind you, and then we'll go here.
In your comment, is there a question mark? Of course there's a question mark. Because the reality is, as a marketer of films, as reality, there are so many reviews out there. There is so much out there that's irresponsible journalism, and it is so viral at this point that there is no ability to correct it, to change it. So as a result, you are all potentially very responsible people. But the amount of people that are out there that are not responsible, the reason why film criticism is in the state that it's in is because of the internet. It is, you know, you talk about independent films surviving in any kind of theatrical way. If there are not advocates, thoughtful, responsible advocates, which are film critics in general, not 22-year-olds, that, well, we have been 22-year-olds, that potentially do not have a glossary of information of cinema. I mean, there's no reason that people like David Anson are no longer reviewing films. And that is a problem, because what happens is then generationally, film criticism dies.
Well, there are two things going, there are two separate things going on here. The one is that there are plenty of smart, incredibly talented 22-year-olds writing about film. There are plenty of enormously incompetent, chimp-like 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds writing about film. The other thing is that, I think it was maybe W.B. Du Bois said that, paraphrasing, the state of the African-American arts is such that the only implement available to the critic is not simply the pom-pom and the baton. A lot of the times people say to you, how could you dislike my independent film? And the answer is based upon its merits. The name of the game is be hit and hit back, and a lot of the times you will write a responsible, rational, articulate review of an independent film and be viewed as Satan for not getting behind it and pushing it.
I don't have a problem if you love it or hate it. That is, you know, it's subjective. You're entitled to your opinion, and you deserve to have your own opinion. My point is that there's a vehicle through the internet right at this point, and from Twitter and everything else, that is so incredibly viral, that how do you regulate, or what kind of system is there that's even possible so that information that is not, I mean, I thought it was interesting that John said, like, for example, LATimes.com is reporting on Lindsay Lohan naked, not within the calendar section, because that's more substantial.
Well, they have a slightly different take. They will report some of our stories. They have slightly different takes. But one thing I want to say about criticism, because I think it's a very good point, and this is, first of all, I think the market, you know, if there is such thing as market forces, they will eventually weed out those lesser voices. But this gets back to this whole instant analysis thing. Kenny Turan, who is our critic, is here, and he sees, you know, 6 or 7 movies a day. 5 or 6 of those he may not like that much. But rather than come out of the screen and say, God, this movie blows, he aggregates his thoughts and he picks the movies that he thinks are worth singling out and writing about. And I think that's the fundamental difference between a lot of online content and what the LA Times is doing.
That's exactly what I do.
Right. So, and I think there's an audience for both, but Kenny is saying if he doesn't like the movie, he's not going to write about it. He's going to pick movies that he thinks deserve, that he likes and that deserve, you know, singling out and praise.
But I would argue that Carina is the future and that there will be new models for criticism in the future and that David Anson and others will find a new way to get their work out.
I mean, honestly,
we're just waiting to figure it out.
Honestly, the only thing I care about is advocating for good film and keeping film culture alive. So right now I'm doing that via a blog. If there's going to be another way for me to do that, I'll do it that way. You know, it's just, for me, the medium is not important.
But if a movie is horrible and terrible, why do you even bother twittering about it? Why don't you ignore it and let it go away?
I don't usually. Do you follow me on Twitter?
No.
But you can. But now that you're responsible to write a review of the film that is negative.
I mean,
that's part of the conversation of film.
I just try really hard to you know, I leave so many hours in a day. I know as a reader that there's a limit to what people can take in, so I try to put my energy towards supporting filmmakers that I think deserve to be supported. And sometimes I will, you know, sort of deflate something that needs deflating, but I try to put my energy on the other side.
Well, as a reader, I have to say some of the most entertaining reviews you'll ever read are the ones that are pans, you know, by a good writer.
And I know people whose modus operandi of writing is everything's terrific or terrific in a special way. And that might as well be doing publicity. Pauline Kael said there are two kinds of writing about film. A good, honest review, and everything else, which is kind of publicity.
I mean, but Mary, I think you're talking about two different things, honestly. One is the demise of the critic, but that is a very, very sad thing. And I, from where I sit, don't really know how to counterbalance it or how to make that work in the model that I'm trying to figure out. And I love reading good criticism.
But what you're talking about really is the place that you're coming from is how does independent film survive without the support of critics and of educated critics and people who know how to find them in something other than Rotten Tomatoes. That pretty much is where people go now is Rotten Tomatoes or MRQE or whatever the aggregating things are. And the answer may well be that that it doesn't survive the theatrical experience, which would be a shame, except in specialty houses. But I think that a lot of things in the next 10 years are going to go away. And that's probably one of them.
Do you know, you pay your reporters, you said you don't pay for commentary, do you pay critics to share? Do you pay for film reviews?
That's commentary. I don't actually carry film criticism on the site.
It might be a great thing you could do to help out.
What I'm saying is I have a certain amount of capital, and I may have to make certain choices as a startup. And one of the choices, painful or other, that I made was not to have paid criticism on the site. And in fact, we don't really have criticism yet. It's something that we absolutely have to have, and I feel the lack of it every Friday or whatever the day we ought to be there. We've had people we do have critics coming out of the site who are blogging, like Dustin Thompson is an old colleague of mine from the Washington Post, just wrote a blog about Tyson, and somebody else just wrote a blog about Ron Howard and Angels, and they did that in the commentary section of the site. I haven't figured out how to formally include criticism on a weekly basis.
I believe you write a check.
Except that if I run out of money, then we just shut down. That doesn't do anybody any good, is what I'm saying.
All right, so I want to get a couple more questions from the audience. The state of film criticism is certainly a really important topic, we'll have to come back to that. There's a woman who's been waiting patiently, and there's a gentleman over here who has a question as well.
Okay, my name's Julie, and I do advertising operations for a kids' website. So I'm just kind of here for general interest, but what I see is CPC rates are going down, CPMs are going down, advertising doesn't bring in as much as it used to online, there's lots of websites out there, so I'm thinking at some point we have to go back to the subscription model for news, really high quality news, and if your top readers are, Googling for porn and going to your site, they're probably leaving right away, so it kind of does expose. So I just would like to kind of get your thoughts on what are the possibilities of subscription models. Is it possible that high quality blogs can, combine together and you pay a subscription fee and I got my 50 greatest blogs that I can go to as opposed to because I wouldn't have found some of your blogs because I'm not Googling masturbation next time or something like that. So that's my one question. And the other thing is, for the next generation of journalists, should they be applying to the LA Times, or should they be starting their own?
There aren't any jobs available.
I think that's true. Let me speak for the subscription model for newspapers. It hasn't worked. There's one newspaper that's been able to succeed, and that's the Wall Street Journal. And I think that's because they have business clients who are able to expense it. The New York Times tried with its op-ed columnists and it failed. The LA Times tried with its calendar section and it was a fiasco. Because I think so many people were used to getting it for free, they had no interest in paying for it. I mean, I think it's a legitimate question. The LA Times, like anybody else, has to figure out a way to get people to pay for the content because you're right, the advertising money can't support it. But people don't subscribe to the paper the way they used to, and they're not used to paying for any other newspaper outside the Journal on a subscription model.
I gotta say, I wish that there was a film magazine that I loved that I could subscribe to, but there isn't. I personally would subscribe to a network like that, but I have a feeling that most of my readers wouldn't. My most dedicated readers, I think, are a very, very small group of people, and even if they did, each were willing to spend $10 a year or whatever, it wouldn't be a windfall of profit.
But also, why is it that if I want to buy an actual physical magazine, which is nice to read in bed or on a plane or in facilities, that writes about mainstream film in an intelligent way, I have to look to Empire or Total Film in England? There's no equivalent domestic product. It's incredibly depressing.
Yeah, Anne and I both use the word premiere.
We can cry about that.
Yeah, you brought up two really good points, though. I don't know if you may come to this as a new... as an outsider, but you made two very perceptive points. One is that I think that a business model that does work is bringing together
all the different blogs that are interesting in any particular subject area, and selling advertising across the aggregation of all of that traffic. And that's something that we're going to start doing, and we're looking to start doing. So we'll have, you know, you have the mothership, but as a business proposition, you want to be able to give access to advertisers to similar kinds of people, similar interests. This already exists, by the way, in the fine arts world. There's an arts, some kind of advertising network for fine arts blogs, and God only knows how much money there is in advertising in that sector. At least we're in the movie industry where there's some real money in marketing budgets. So that is something that works. There was another point you brought up that I can't recall.
But I mean, we're actually part of a blog network, and it's fine, but it, you know, we could make more money if we weren't, because at the current model of blog networks doesn't distribute very much money to each individual blog.
I'm curious about that. You're on a movie blog?
We're part of a culture blog network.
Culture blog network, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's an advertising model. It's not a subscription model.
Right, now, I was just saying, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Why is she going to start it?
Yeah.
There seems to be a philosophy on the internet right now that a lot of people belong to so many different places that they're not willing to join a new one. That, you know, with the Facebook and the LinkedIn and the Twitter and everything else, that it's very difficult to get people to sign up for something new.
I just want to say, the conventional wisdom, which I think for the most part is true, is that people will not pay for content, the exception being, of course, the Wall Street Journal. But I think that first of all, that, like everything else, has to be examined and re-examined all the time to figure out how to make news organizations live. And I, for one, although I'm not committed to this myself in terms of what we're doing, but I wouldn't rule it out, I believe that in niche-oriented publications, that could work. And there are, among the people who interviewed with me for jobs, people who have, in one place that's still hiring is the Los Angeles, I think it's, the legal journal, there's a weekly legal journal, and it's subscription only. You cannot get it unless you have a subscription. So if you're a lawyer or a law firm.
Daily Journal,
thank you. The Daily Journal. Then they never took down their paywall for their internet site either. So people who have business-oriented information that people need, they have to do their jobs, I think that subscription model is something that should probably still be pursued.
And in the case of IndieWire, just to point out, we're in the process of developing a plan and still exploring how to implement it that would create essentially a partnership or a network among not only other entities but individual writers as well. And we're experimenting with this idea, we're still developing it, we're talking to a lot of folks about it. Certainly don't know what the answers are, and we're trying to figure it out. And I think that where things are today and where they'll be in a year or 2 years, you know, the differences will be quite striking. Couple more questions if we can, yes.
Hello, my name is Nick Kern. I'm a film editor and a freelance blogger, and I'm actually 22.
Sorry, I didn't really mean to say
that. No, no problem. But my question is actually about using or getting hit volume. Have any of you used StumbleUpon for any traffic like that? Because it's a web page where you can.
I tried it and I couldn't quite figure it out.
We get a lot of traffic from StumbleUpon. We get a lot of traffic from StumbleUpon, and you know, I mean, we're not like the most div-friendly site in the world, but that's what 10 masturbation scenes is good for. And actually, when we do things like 10 masturbation scenes, we try to do it A, tongue-in-cheek, and to make it, you know, with some actual intelligent commentary. I mean, we referenced Andrew Saris in our masturbation post.
Did you add Antichrist?
What?
Did you add Antichrist?
Well, we're going to have to now.
And it'll now be 11 best.
I think there's two.
Bonus round.
And I want to make sure that Corinne's site is given its proper credit, because it's not all about masturbation films. Corinne is a serious journalist, a serious critic, who is writing thoughtful criticism. And I want to ask a question of you, Corinne, in that regard, because I was thinking back during this panel to the symposium that the Museum of Moving Image did last summer, and you were there with some other folks. And
yeah, that was depressing.
It was depressing. It really, I remember a comment that I think you made, talking with other journalists, probably some who lost their jobs in the time since then, that at the time that you signed on for this, you sort of, it was probably clear that what you were aspiring towards.
It's
not as clear.
Well, I have a graduate degree in cinema studies from NYU, and I started started blogging professionally while I was in the process of getting that degree. So at that time, you know, I knew that I wasn't going to be an academic because I have more of a pop culture sensibility, but at the same time, I have kind of, you know, too smart of a sensibility for a lot of, you know, contemporary entertainment magazines. So I applied for an internship at Entertainment Weekly, and they told me I was too academic, and I applied for an internship at FilmCommon, and they told me I was too pop. So I, even then, even in my last couple of years of school, like, I knew that the market wasn't, you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities, but I really did think that I'd write on the internet for a while, and then eventually I'd get a job in a magazine. And now, you know, there's, I don't harbor delusions about getting a real job, you know, writing for print. I do freelance for Time Out New York and a few other print places here and there, but yeah, I don't feel like I have a bar to reach for. I just don't, I have no idea. I have no idea what my career path could possibly be. And I, you know, sometimes I get really scared about that, but usually it's just sort of, I can't do anything about it. I just kind of have to wait and see and keep on creating opportunities for myself wherever I can.
Assuming you don't go on to churning butter or working at going back to the cheese counter, as I know that James is in his 20s, but as the resident,
it is wrong.
As the resident 20-something, the solutions for some of this will rest on your shoulders if your goal is to preserve film culture, which I think that many of us in this room and on this panel feel very strongly about as well. Let me put you on the spot and ask you sort of, as you're taking in what you're hearing on this panel, what you're seeing at the festival, the way you're seeing the landscape change over the past few months, at the very least, where do you think it should go?
I don't have a specific answer for that because I feel like I've been sort of in that realm of soul searching for at least a year since that symposium. I will say that over the past 6 months, I've seen an incredible thing happen that I never would have expected, which is that suddenly people who care about art film are using Twitter and having conversations about it. Twitter is not there's a lot of things that can potentially be done on Twitter, but what I'm seeing is people who work for distributors like Zeitgeist having conversations with their consumers. And it all happening in this really friendly, like, flat level. You know, something is happening there that I don't see that was happening on blogs at some point, but now I feel like the blog market is just getting so crowded that it's not happening as much. And I'm not saying that, you know, there isn't a business model for film critics on Twitter, for sure. But that is probably the one thing about film culture that has excited me recently in terms of something new happening.
I think the model for everyone who writes about film right now is the model for everyone who works right now, which is keep doing what you do until somebody tells you to stop. I don't have a single employer. I don't have any kind of ambit handed down to me. I just have to keep on finding new places to do it until somebody tells me to stop. And I think that's going to apply for everyone. And I wouldn't have it any other way, because at the end of the day, for all of the bemoaning and the constant echo chamber of with a film criticism, for all of that, for the past 12 years, I've made a living and I don't owe anybody anything, and I've never had to write anything I don't believe to be true. There's a lot of people who would stand on my chest and cut my throat to be able to say that. Sorry, I have a graphic image. Von Trier's rub off on me.
Last couple questions, and then we're running out of time. There's one up here, one back there, yes. Trustee Orr.
My name is Maggie Abram. Well, this is my name, Maggie. And really, my job now is just being able to keep reading people I care about, I think, move to other outlets and trying to all exist as this world changes. And with that said, because you all have to reinvent yourselves and how you're working, I'm curious with your comments, because obviously your blogs are also about that you can get so many comments. Is that more doing it for art, of course, or do you actually read through your comments and find yourself getting a lot of leads that way, a lot of commentary? I mean, do you find that really, is that how you're doing reporting now, is also through a lot of your comments?
One,
do you even care?
One in 100 comments will have a factual correction or an interesting point or a brand new perspective. The other 99 are produced by the fact that the internet offers people two things no grown-up should want, which is instant gratification and absolute anonymity. Comments are terrifying and grim, and reading them will make you feel physically ill in your soul, with that 1 in 100 exception. But by and large, I mean...
I totally disagree with that. I'm going to just jump right in. I think comments are absolutely part of the give-and-take conversation that journalism and news consumption and understanding our world is now about. I learn all the time from our commenters. I sometimes have invited our commenters to become polyglotters, as we call them outside, polyglotters. And they've become, a particular one of us, become one of our most insightful commentators on public relations. They do it under an alias. I think that, sure, the cloak ban, it depends. I also believe that...
2 in 100.
Well, then come on the site and read our comments. It's very different. No, actually, it's part of the conversation, and that is absolutely part of what I believe journalism has to become, which is a virtuous circle of, we start with high-quality news content that we've gone out and reported, and it improves as readers comment on it, and then we go out and we report on that based on what we've learned, and that feeds a cycle of better information and a better experience for everybody. But I think it does set a tone, too, you're going to have those jerks who are going to be commenting, and you want it, and that is the cloak of anonymity does give people license to do that, and that's hard.
I need my commenters to let me know when I make a mistake, which is always very helpful, and I also really use them to find out what's hot. I mean, if I get a huge number of comments, I learn that Twilight is a phenomenon, or I learn that Superman, anytime I write about Superman or Twilight, I will always get enormous numbers of comments, and you just have to follow the zeitgeist. It's very useful that way, but it's unusual that I would get a real tip for a new story. That doesn't happen that often.
Well, and I'm fortunate in that I have no idea what kind of web traffic my stories get. People above me do, and that's their job, but I can certainly tell from the number of comments whether or not I've written about something that's relevant or important. I mean, there are stories that I'm really proud of that get no comments, and that's in some ways really heartbreaking, and there's maybe trivial stories I'll do that will get a lot of comments. So in some ways it's a false measure for me in terms of what I should be doing, but it's always, I always read them.
I mean, I agree with Sharon that it's absolutely a necessary element of what the internet is all about, to have that conversation space and for people to be able to tell me I'm wrong or to, you know, take the conversation to wherever they want to take it. At the same time, I get a lot of hate comments. A lot of it is kind of misogynistic and, you know, it can be really hurtful. So usually I will... If I see that a post is kind of gaining steam in that way, that's when I start ignoring it. But in general, I do keep an eye on it and participate.
To bring it back around, I think 1 in 100 or 2 in 100 may be hyperbole, because comments are an important part of it, and discourse is, with a much greater noise-to-signal ratio. The bad thing about comments is that you actually have editors or superiors saying, we know we want this to be written in a way that will get comments. Well, it's easy to write things in a way that gets comments. Just be wrong, be vulgar, be sex-obsessed, be artificially contentious, go so far around the horn from smart that you come back to stupid. Writing for comments is hurting serious film culture and serious film writing, and it's something I have no interest in doing, and something more and more people want you to do. I'm not interested in being deliberate.
Well, every comment is 2-page views, right?
Right, and that's like, I don't know how to do that, which again is why I'm fated for churning butter.
As a way of wrapping up, I understand, or I just learned that we have a, person, watching this panel from Sarasota Film Consortium. Film Festival. And a question has been sent in.
Two people!
Welcome. The question was, is there a value, this is about teaching journalism and where journalism goes, I guess. Is there a value in teaching Twitter and Facebook to journalism students? I would expand on that question to maybe answer the question by thinking about sort of how we look at the way journalism is changing and how we should be teaching journalism in an era when it's literally changing from month to month.
I don't think that there should be courses on Facebook or Twitter. First of all, because these things go out of fashion so quickly. I mean, I don't know the last time I checked MySpace. Also, I just think that participation in those things should be really organic and natural, and it should be an extension of the way you use them to just communicate, not just, you know, I mean, it should all be about communication, and it shouldn't necessarily be about, you know, the right way to do it.
I'll jump in on that. I mean, I think, you know, good reporting is good reporting, and it doesn't matter the vehicle through which it's delivered. I mean, I think the best film reporter of the LA Times is Patrick Goldstein, who writes a film blog. I mean, his stuff is reverse published into the newspaper, but he's a journalist first whose material happens to be published in a blog, and then we reverse publish it in the newspaper. I mean, Sharon had a great story today about relativity. Eugene, you had a great story a week ago about outrage. I mean, but that's all reporting. You know, yours is on your site, Anne is doing her news on her site. So I don't think it really, I hope that we're kind of site agnostic or delivery system agnostic, but I think for journalism students, if you don't know how to report and don't know how to write, it doesn't matter how you're gonna be delivered, because if it's not any good, people won't read it.
I think saying you have to teach people how to use Facebook and Twitter now is like saying you have to teach them, and here is how you turn the computer on, and here is how you open a Word document. I think J schools would be better, you know, better teach ethics and judgment as opposed to how to use Twitter and Facebook.
My last question is just to ask the panelists to look into the crystal ball, and I won't ask you to go beyond 5 years, or I won't even ask you to go beyond 3 years, because we can look that far ahead. What should we be keeping an eye on in the next 6 months, year, 2 years? Where do you think this will go? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? That's an open-ended question to sort of just give you an opportunity to make some final thoughts.
The media landscape?
Sure.
I think as in every aspect of human endeavor right now, things are going to get far worse, and that ideally, if we're smart, they'll get much better. I mean, you can look at every time of crisis like this, and, you know, how much of it is damage control and how much of it is looking back wisely and going, how did we get here, and making a plan to make sure we don't go back. Are we going to get the crisis? Guaranteed. Are we going to get the wise looking back and the planning going forward? Probably not.
And part B, what should we do?
Whatever we can. I make sure that I read things that I want to read. I make sure that I support people who I want to read. I make sure I support publications I want to read. You know, live as you will, and that's all you can do on an individual ethical level as a consumer and creator of media.
I'm optimistic by nature, but I think there's a profound challenge that lies ahead, and that is that people are not willing or able or doing, and they're not paying for news anymore. And I think that's a huge problem for everybody who's up here. I mean, our jobs depend on people paying for our content. If it's advertisers, if it's subscribers, and if that money goes away, I think we're all in very bad shape. And I think there's a generation of readers, of consumers of news, of music, of movies that are not used to paying for it. And I think that's a huge problem. And until that is solved, or until people realize, and, you know, forget about the film business, think about international affairs and politics and war. If people are not paying for news, those stories are not going to get written. So regardless of how it affects Harvey Weinstein, a world in which people are not paying for news and are not news reporters is a very depressing thought.
I do have some hope that all the money that goes into cutting down trees and delivering newspapers and delivering them to the doors of people, that, you know, this is such an expensive and difficult thing to do. I think that there will be investment in online, and that the reporters will continue to be able to do what they're doing. And there is a demand for it, and it has to exist. On another note, in terms of all the research and running around that I've been doing, I'm very aware that there are a lot of young startups, new companies, new models, lots of people trying to reinvent a lot of different things. And I see someone like Chris Hyams here from B-Side, and I see Matt Dentler here from Synetic Media. There are a lot of people trying to figure these things out, and we're going to find some solutions, I think.
Yeah, I'm incredibly optimistic, but that's because we just started, and we have a lot of momentum, and we had such great response from the community. But I do, how do we move forward? I think, honestly, that more journalists have to be willing to think
think more proactively about how to pull resources, pull their assets, pull their talent together and start creating these new models, which is, I mean, I'm speaking what I'm living, and I'm here to tell you that it seems very impossible and daunting, but it just, it's like step by step by step, something has to replace the institutions that are dying, but we have to create those institutions, those new models and those new organizations ourselves, and it can be done. That it will not look like the LA Times in 10 years from now. It will look very different. I believe it will look like smaller organizations that are much more nimble and that are much tighter on cost, and I believe that probably fewer people will be able to do professional journalism in the next 20 years, and anybody who wants to do non-professional journalism can already do it. But I think that we have to take our destiny into our own hands if we want journalism to survive. That's what, but from my perspective, I'm optimistic.